U.S. businesses thrive on Alibaba's online marketplace, where sales by American companies to Chinese consumers added $53 billion to the U.S. economy in 2022. Discover more at AlibabaPowersBusinesses.com.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Joe Biden is sworn into office as the 46th president of the United States. And what does he have planned for his busy first day in office? Welcome. I'm Kyle Peterson with the Wall Street Journal. We're joined today by my colleagues, WSJ columnists Kim Strassel and Bill McGurn. As we tape this, Biden is still giving his inaugural address outside in front of the Capitol. He's just been sworn in by Chief Justice John Roberts. And it's a bit of an unusual sight. The crowd is in masks, sitting distance, 6 feet apart. There were 200,000 little flags planted on the National Mall to represent people who could not attend the ceremonies in person during the pandemic. There is lots of National Guard in town. And instead of the inaugural balls tonight, there will be a TV event featuring Tom Hanks and Bruce Springsteen and John Bon Jovi. So, Bill, some of the pageantry of the inauguration is there, but it looks a little bit different this year.
Right. It's pared down because of COVID, but it's still impressive. I've been watching all morning, and it's still impressive. I mean, it's also impressive partly because it's based on, you know, two centuries of doing this. It does represent an extraordinary thing, a peaceful transfer of power. I'm not a Joe Biden supporter, but it's his day, and it's a very, you know, it's a very powerful witness, and I can imagine people around the world watching this. It's very inspiring.
We don't have much of Biden's speech yet. I jotted down a few phrases in his opening. This is paraphrases. He's talking about setting our sights on the nation we know we can be, saying that there's much to repair, much to restore, much to heal. So far, Kim, it seems like he is hitting on the themes he did in his campaign of bringing the country together and sort of vague calls for unity.
Right. And good for him. And I think this is the tone that you need in something like this. He obviously ran his entire campaign on unity. He seems to have had a harder time actually following up on that post-election. I think there's been a lot of barbs and it's been just pretty fractious. So, you know, maybe this is the beginning of a Biden that at least what he campaigned on. I think the real question, though, going forward is going to be, can he stand up to his progressive left that is offering the most radical policies and the things that are most likely to sow a lot of division? He's got a Democratic Congress. In some cases, that might normally be a kind of trigger to feel like, well, we can do whatever we want. But if this guy really believes in sort of national unity and healing, then reaching across the aisle is going to be a good first start. We'll see. That'll be the bigger proof rather than this address. But it's nice to hear.
Yeah, I mean, it does strike me, Bill, that Kim is right here. I mean, this is one of the big questions of the Biden presidency is he's talking about unity and bringing people together. And at the same time, he campaigned on really one of the most progressive presidential agendas that we've seen in a long time. Trillions in tax increases, trillions in spending, including a Green New Deal, free four-year college for middle-class families, public option in healthcare. And it's not clear to me how you square that circle, unless what he really means is you guys come unify with me and do what I want, ask my agenda.
Kyle, I was feeling so happy about the moment just to a few minutes ago, but after you rattle off that list, I think you're right. The other part about that agenda, though, is that, the public, I think, assumes that majorities just act as majorities when they have them. But, as we know, it's much more fractious. And with the slight majorities they have in the House and the Senate, it becomes limited. You're always worried that you're going to have a few defectors. In some ways, it's harder to be the party that has a one or two vote advantage than the party that doesn't, because the party that doesn't not expected to do anything, and they might poach someone off. They're kind of being aggressive, where you're always on the defensive the other way. I would say a big factor, you know, Kim alluded to the words of unity and healing and not really being backed up. I would say that the better path to unity, we're not going to get it on policy so much. I mean, it would be good if the president and the Republicans could compromise on things if they're going to pass, not just take absolutist positions. That would be welcome. But I think what people are looking for now in terms of the unity and healing is maybe to get other members of his party to stop referring to every Trump voter as an insurrectionist or white supremacist. And maybe it's not worth pursuing Donald Trump now that he's left the presidency, now that he's no longer president, you know, if your purpose really is to bring people together. Because a lot of Trump voters really feel that they're still treated as deplorables. And the effort is not just to disagree with them, but to drive them out of polite society. So I think there are opportunities for Biden, but I think it would take, you know, a willingness, you know, maybe not in public, but to get other leaders in his party to get aboard the program and really make the effort instead of sort of demonizing a lot of these people.
I think those are fair points on the policy front, though. I mean, I do wonder whether Biden is trying to execute a little bit of a turn toward the center. I mean, I kept waiting for that after he won the presidential nomination, and it just kept not happening. He kept rolling out these policy plans. And I do have to say that I'm a little bit surprised at some of his cabinet picks. We don't have a Treasury Secretary Elizabeth Warren or a Labor Secretary Bernie Sanders. I mean, some of that obviously has to do with the close division of the Congress, not wanting to take anybody out of action there. But Kim, do you detect any slight turn toward the center here, maybe in these cabinet picks?
Well, look, I think, as you said, the cabinet picks have overall been probably better than they could have been. I think a lot of us, as you said, were fearing a sort of, you know, Bernie Sanders labor secretary or something, which is a little bit of a terrifying thought. Some of those, though, I think those calculations were actually made by indeed the closest in the Senate, and the fact that if you were to take some of those stars in the Senate out, you would have an issue where you had Republican governors that could replace them and potentially have a problem with the balance of power in there. I think what the biggest theme is of most of his cabinet picks is that it's a return, in essence, to the Obama administration. And that has, to me, been the more kind of durable theme going on here in terms of Biden's cabinet picks. Now, in some ways, especially on, you know, in some ways, that's reassuring, because these days you look at the Obama era, even though I looked at it as the most progressive presidency that the United States had ever had, it looks fairly tame by comparison to the agenda of an Elizabeth Warren. So that's a little reassuring. There are nonetheless some picks that I think are going to have a really hard time getting through. You know, we had some of the opening hearings yesterday. There's going to be a big fight, seems to be brewing, for instance, over the Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin and whether or not a military waiver will be granted him. The Department of Homeland Security, Mayorkas, who was nominated. There are some real issues that are being brought up about an Inspector General report against him a couple of years ago, talking about how he intervened in a prior post to help Democratic donors get special visas. So this could be a pretty tumultuous coming weeks, not just because of the nature of some of the picks, but some of their history too.
Hang tight. We'll be right back. You're listening to Potomac Watch from the Wall Street Journal.
U.S. businesses thrive on Alibaba's online marketplace, where sales by American companies to Chinese consumers added $53 billion to the U.S. economy in 2022. Discover more at AlibabaPowersBusinesses.com.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Welcome back. One more question about the pageantry here. I mean, I have had the C-SPAN broadcast of the inaugural up on my screen and have spotted President George W. Bush and President Clinton at the swearing in. Vice President Pence is there. But President Trump, everyone knows, has left town. And obviously, a peaceful transfer of power doesn't require everybody to get along. And Trump is not the first president to skip the next guy's inauguration. But Bill, it does seem to me that you'll lose something, that a handshake and a handoff is a nice piece of this transfer of the Democratic liturgy. And I'm missing it this year.
Yeah, I agree entirely with you. Pageantry and these kind of symbolic gestures, they're very important. They reflect a continuity. It's a kind of thing that you do on thinking. It's kind of like, you know, in school, Kyle, I don't know if you've ever broken up by a teacher, you know, after having a fist fight, and then the teacher makes you shake hands with the other guy whom you're glowering at. But it's good for people to do that. Look, I'm not one of the people that is always lecturing Donald Trump on civility. I mean, some of the people that give those lectures could use a lesson themselves. But I do think we lost something. I think he lost something in not being there for it, just sucking it up. I can understand his anger. I think he was impeached twice over very recklessly. But I still think that this is why we have those things. I mean, part of the reason is to rise above the acrimony. And it is a loss. And I think it's a loss for the nation, because I think it means more people watching this are bitter than they otherwise might have been if President Trump had been there. But it's done, and we have to live with the consequences.
Once President Biden finishes with his inaugural address, he has quite a first day planned, lots of executive orders to sign. And so we can go through some of that. Two immediate actions that he says he will take are to first bring the U.S. back into the Paris Climate Agreement, and second, bring the U.S. back into the World Health Organization. And just one thought, Kim, on the latter. I mean, even if Biden were committed to reentering the WHO, he knew he wanted to do it. I don't quite see why he wouldn't at least try to get some kind of reform out of the deal.
Absolutely. Look, I think this is one of my issues with a lot of Biden's executive orders and a lot of the stances that he's taken so far since he was elected, which it kind of goes to what Bill was just saying. The acrimony has been so huge that there appears to be almost this knee-jerk reaction that whatever Donald Trump did, you must do the opposite. Rather than looking at the policy question at hand and wondering if there isn't some merit to it. I mean, I was actually really struck that yesterday some of Biden's incoming cabinet members agreed with the Trump administration's designation of genocide for China in terms of its actions against the Uyghurs. It was almost surprising. It would seem obvious and good for them for actually doing it, but has not, in fact, been the way that they have approached nearly any policy thing. And that is especially the case with this decision on the WHO. The reason that Donald Trump withdrew, whether or not you agree that that was the exact right way to go, was because there are some real problems with that organization in which they seem to not be as focused on their mission as they are on politics at times, which has led to some very bad judgments. And so, you know, if we as a nation are going to be involved in these international institutions, our basic duty is to require competence. And we have a unique ability to do that because of the amount of money that we send to them. And so you would think, yes, at the very least, that would have been a negotiating basis for coming back in, that Biden would have demanded a little bit more.
Right. And not to, you know, push this point too far, but even if he disagreed with the decision to leave, the fact that we're in the process of leaving, Bill, strikes me as leverage. And I just don't know why you would give up that leverage on the first day without even having a conversation about how can we structure this organization a little bit better.
I think that's the rational interpretation. Of course, what the president wants to do with the executive on the first day is look energetic, mark a real turn from the previous administration, and you know, really give succor to your allies and the people out there that are looking for you to make a difference. You know, Joe Biden's not any different in doing this than other presidents were. You know, some of these executive orders basically overturn Trump decisions and Trump executive orders. I do wish we would get away from executive orders to the degree we can, because it shows how brittle they are. If we just go back and forth with different orders, what we really need to do if we want unity is to come together for legislative purposes and make compromises on each side. Actually, that's something that Joe Biden's very good at. He's not an absolutist. He spent his time in the Senate making deals. So I would hope that we move away from this and that we move more to legislation. But I do think it's understandable on the first day a president wants to show that he's vigorous, that he's in charge, and go bang, bang, bang. Here are, you know, some important things that my people, my voters have been looking for, and I'm going to give them. It gets a lot trickier when it moves from there to an actual legislative agenda.
Another order that is slated for Biden's day one signature is he says he's going to revoke the permit granted to the Keystone XL pipeline. And just as a reminder, this is the project that is intended to carry crude oil from Alberta, Canada, to Nebraska, where it's going to link up with another pipeline going to the Gulf Coast. And one thing that I think is especially notable about this, Kim, is that it's already under construction. So the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation says, I'll just read a line here, the Canadian leg of the project has been under construction for several months with around 1,000 workers. And so it strikes me as a problem, and maybe the builders there have some legal recourse if they've already started building it and the permit's going to get canceled.
Yeah, and not just a problem legally from a business perspective. Again, I think this gets to the question of knee-jerk responses to certain things. This is potentially a problem in terms of our relationship with Canada, which is one of our closest neighbors. This development project has been important for them as well. And especially when you go back and look through history, one of the problems with this was that the initial attempts to stop it and delay it were so politicized. It was generally greeted with great happiness among many Canadians when that politicization finally came to an end and the United States once again proceeded on the basis of our own rules and law and order. Biden is throwing all this away. There is potentiality for a lawsuit. There's a potentiality for just a case of whether or not he even has the authority to do this as well, too, given that we do have a process for how this is supposed to happen. I would also add that while Keystone XL is getting most of the attention, that executive order that Biden is signing is actually further directing agencies to review and reverse more than 100 Trump actions on the environment. And once again, that gets to, and I keep using this word, but this almost reflexive response. How do you just come up with 100 projects, a nice round number there, that you're just going to get rid of without actually having done the review first? This seems to be going from the opposite direction. It says they will review and reverse, as if that's already the decision about their quality or merit has already been made, despite no review.
Biden's team also says he'll sign an executive order, quote, requiring masks and physical distancing in all federal buildings, on all federal lands, and by federal employees and contractors. And what's interesting to me about that is it looks like a little bit of backing off. Last year, Biden was talking about a national mask mandate. And Bill, a lot of people, including me, we're thinking that the president of the United States absolutely does not have the power to order Americans from Juneau to Key West to wear masks. And well, so I guess credit for staying within his powers there.
Right. I mean, look, I think the worst thing you can do is issue an order that's overturned or something because it stretches too far. Look, I think this was always a lot about theater, the whole mask debate. I'm very skeptical of masks. I wear them out of politeness. You know, people are nervous without them. But I think when we analyze the benefits, they're very slim. the evidence for it. There are other things that I think are more effective, you know, like circulating air or so forth. So it's a little bit of about a reality, but since he went so far out on that limb, Kyle, and even as you correctly suggest, it's probably unconstitutional, but he went so far out, I don't think he could completely drop it. So he came up with this. That's what political leaders do. I don't think it's going to have any appreciable effect on COVID, but I think he almost had to do it given how far out on a limb he had gone, how much he had made masks such an issue. I mean, the debate changes so quickly, right? And a year ago, I mean, the mask debate is such an old one with what we now know going on. So I think this was a political gesture to save face.
President Biden is also planning some quick movement on immigration. And there, what's interesting is he's sort of following the point that Bill made earlier about proceeding with legislation. So he says that he will immediately act to preserve DACA, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. But then there's also some reporting on a big legislative push. The Associated Press says that he plans a sweeping immigration bill to provide an 8-year path to citizenship for an estimated 11 million people living in the U.S. without legal status. And supposedly this bill is going to run into hundreds of pages. So it's not something they apparently dreamed up last night or a couple days ago. And agree or disagree with the policy, Kim, it seems to me that this is the way to proceed, is propose a bill and have the president argue the case for it.
Absolutely. I was thrilled to see that because, you know, the funny thing is, it's one of the few legislative items Biden has even talked about. We've had lots of talk of spending, in particular, this new COVID relief bill that he is proposing. And one of the things that's a little disturbing about that is it seems to be a vehicle for a lot of Democratic priorities that go beyond COVID. But this is one of the few discrete legislative ideas that he's put forward. And it is a way to go. You know, I think this is going to be an increasing theme in coming years. We have a lot more Trump judges, many of whom are very focused on administrative law. And I think that they're going to have, the courts are going to have more and more trouble with people just trying to push things through via regulation. But so happy to see this. I think the caveat is that while this is an area that there's a lot of potential for Democrats and Republicans to do something together on, those areas kind of fall around some discrete issues where there has been growing agreement among the parties. This bill, by contrast, is as you say, a very sweeping piece of legislation. It includes a lot of liberal priorities that go well beyond any place where Republicans are right now. And so I think the risk of it is, while it is good to see legislation, that this is already setting a very bad framework for one of the few areas where there might have been a little bit of cooperation between both sides.
Well, we'll see. We'll have to see what its prospects are when it gets to Congress and how much President Biden, the consummate legislator, is willing to compromise there. But for now, thank you, Kim and Bill. Thank you all for listening. We'll be back later this week with another edition of Potomac Watch.
U.S. businesses thrive on Alibaba's online marketplace, where sales by American companies to Chinese consumers added $53 billion to the U.S. economy in 2022. Discover more at AlibabaPowersBusinesses.com.